Du lytter til High Five Girls podcast, hvor der bliver gjort op med den skæve kønsfordeling i STEM. Sammen med en række prominente stemmer bryder vi kønsstereotyperne og fokuserer på de mange uddannelses- og karrieremuligheder, der er for kvinder i den her sektor. I denne episode taler vi med Gina Ribbon, som er en britisk forfatter og forsker inden for neurovidenskab. Hun er særlig kendt for at forske i de kognitive ligheder mellem kvinder og mænds hjerner. Med bogen The Gendered Brain gør hun os alle sammen klogere på, hvordan hendes forskning kan være med til at nedbryde fordomme om, at vores køn er med til at bestemme vores præferencer i alt fra legetøj og farver til karrierevalg, og hvordan denne viden kan være med til at skabe lige muligheder for piger og drenge, mænd og kvinder. Da Gina Ribbon kommer fra England, vil resten af denne episode foregå på engelsk. Tak fordi du lytter med.
Everyone, thank you very much for giving this interview. You are a neuroscientist and author to the book The Gendered Brain, the new neuroscience that shatters the myth of the female brain. Can you please introduce your field of research and tell me why you're exploring this field?
Well, I'm as you mentioned, a cognitive neuroscientist, which effectively is exploring the relationship between brain and behavior. And I use brain imaging techniques to do that. At my place of work, we have all the sort of state-of-the-art brain imaging techniques. So what I'm really interested in overall is actually what makes brains different. My main field of research is looking at developmental disorders like autism. So I'm really interested in not how all brains are the same and all have the same way of solving problems, but saying that some people have brains that are different from others, and that has consequences. And of course, once you start exploring research into what makes brains different, you get drawn into the whole field of the differences between brains of men and brains of women. Initially, I was very interested I actually took for granted what was at the time in the 1980s, 1990s, the concept that men's brains were different from women's brains, and as a consequence they had a whole range of different skills. But I was interested in finding ways of characterizing these differences within the brain, so I thought, working backwards, I'll look at the brains of men doing particular tasks and women doing particular tasks, and that'll give me a nice signature of differences between male and female brains. And after quite a long time where I wasn't finding any differences at all, and assuming I was therefore doing something wrong, I thought, well, I'll actually look more carefully into the literature. Where has this idea come from, that men's brains are different from women's brains? How good is the evidence? And it was at that point that I realised the evidence was very flawed, very old ideas which had evolved before we could look at intact living human brains in intact living humans, and therefore it was those ideas that needed to be challenged, and that's how I got into this field. Not necessarily because I was very interested in these differences, but I was interested in the idea as well that an old kind of theory was still informing today's research and needed revising.
Can you please state what is the difference between sex and gender?
Well, I would say, and as I have done in the book, I think if we use the term sex, or the way I use the term sex, is to refer to biological aspects of differences between male and female, determined by chromosomal differences and hormonal differences. And I think that is going right back to the idea that this is, you know, a biological characteristic. And it used to be that word was used for everything. So even if you were interested in behavior, it was sex differences in behavior, different roles in society, it was sex roles in society. But then the term gender became more important. Again, in the 1980s and 90s, looking at the second wave of feminism, saying that actually society had a lot to do with these so-called fixed, invariable, inevitable differences between males and females. So maybe we should forget biology and we should actually look at the expectations that society has of men and women. And that's when the term gender was used. And that term has now actually replaced sex in a lot of particularly popular media conversations. And gender actually refers to any kind of differences between males and females. So you talk about gender gaps in society. You have gender reveal parties, which is another story we might get onto later. But actually what I really think is, and this is what 21st century neuroscience is showing, and actually what a lot of the book is about, the two aspects of human beings are so entangled. We shouldn't actually be referring to them as either or. We should, and I use the term sex stroke gender, and some people talk about gender stroke sex, to acknowledge the fact that these are entangled and we shouldn't be thinking in terms of these either or, nature versus nurture type arguments.
Why is it important to talk about the similarities rather than the differences between the brains?
Great question. Because I think what's embedded in I was going to say public consciousness, but very often in science consciousness as well, is the idea that if you talk about differences, you're talking about group A is like this and group B is like that, and there's no overlap between them. And from that stems all sorts of other beliefs about, you know, what men and women can't do if those are group A and group B. And we have this picture that, you know, these are two distinct species, if you like, the sort of Mars versus Venus trope, which has became popular with self-help books, which came out at the beginning of this century. So I think you have to say we must acknowledge that on any measure that you take, either of brain characteristics or of behavioural characteristics, there is a huge amount of overlap between males and females. The variability within the supposedly biologically homogeneous groups of males and of females is huge. And that is an interesting question which we ignore. And what we focus on is these tiny average differences. So you take a big population, huge amount of overlap between the two groups, tiny, possibly statistically significant difference between them. And that's what we focus on. So we need to make people aware that actually the evidence is that the similarities between males and females are much more widespread, much greater than the differences between them.
Can you try to explain, like, how we are similar brain-wise, men and women?
Well, I think what you could do is actually use the fact that brain imaging, although it has sometimes been a problem, has evolved an amazing way of visualizing what brains look like. I think actually to some extent, neuroscientists have painted themselves into a corner with a focus on structures. This is where the whole argument started, right at the very beginning, and what I say jokingly, characteristic size matters agenda. Early brain scientists, before they could properly look at brains, were saying female brains are inferior. You know, we know that because look at their inferior position in society, etc. Therefore, what we need to do is to look at different structures and find out, you know, where this inferiority comes from. And big excitement, the finding that on average, and that's really important, coming back to the overlapping issue, male brains are about 5 ounces heavier than female. So, you know, big excitement, that's where the differences were. Male brains were bigger, that meant they were better, and that's why they were political leaders or, you know, great explorers or whatever. And pretty soon that idea was scotched because they said, oh, well, you know, sperm whales and elephants have got bigger brains and generally they're not renowned for their political nous or scientific creativity, etc. Who knows? So there's always been this focus on let's look at structures. Let's look at the bridge of fibres between male and female brains. Let's have a look at the thickness of the cortex, the overlying surface of the brain, and see if there's some kind of measure we can come up with which will prove that men's and male and female brains are different. And we've never found one. And last year, Lise Elliott in Chicago and her team did a big survey of 30 years of brain imaging data to say how consistent are these reports of sex differences, because there are thousands of papers reporting sex differences. But what she showed and what has been shown in other areas is that there is no part of the human brain which reliably differentiates a male from a female. So you could say, right, job done. There aren't any differences. But it may well be that we should be looking at much more dynamic dynamic processes. What happens when somebody's listening to a particular narrative, for example, or solving a particular problem? Given that our behaviour is measured on millisecond timescales, we should be looking at the brain in that way and much more dynamic. And I think that is the way forward for neuroscience's input into this debate, to say, you know, there are differences in how people solve problems, and we can demonstrate that at a neuroscientist level, and you can produce very compelling images which demonstrate these differences. So I think although people are still saying there is no difference between the male and female brain, look at the structures, we should be looking at the processes, the functions instead. I think neuroscience also ought to acknowledge that there is no direct one-to-one link between structure and function. So the idea used to be, for example, part of the limbic system, a part of the brain associated with emotional processing, the amygdala was a focus of, you know, a source of aggression, and if you somehow find a way of inhibiting the amygdala, then previously aggressive animals became tame, etc. So there was this nice story emerging that, you know, if you had a bigger X, then you would be better at function Y. And that, again, hasn't stood up to the test of time. So I think those are the kind of issues that we need to acknowledge. The whole idea of what I call blame the brain is a major problem, not only in understanding sex differences, but in, you know, in the law, for example. There is still this idea that if you could prove that somebody who'd you know, shot a whole number of people actually had a tumour in a particular part of the brain, could you plead that that person was not responsible because there was damage to their brain which was causing these behavioural problems? So that's a legal issue, which is, you know, is something which the law is still struggling with, not just neuroscience. But I think the idea always has been that, and this is a reference to something called essential. When essential, another misuse of a term, perhaps, essential means, in these contexts, means it's kind of biological process, so that if your biology determines something, it is an essence that you have. But the term essential in popular use means something really, really important. So if you have an idea that brains of any kind, let's say males and females, are hardwired differently, then the assumption is that you can't change it. And this was always the problem with the early arguments, that there was something fixed and inevitable and invariant about these differences, which of course means that, you know, unless you're going into slightly futuristic biological, genetic, whatever manipulation, you can't do anything about it. So the danger, I think, in focusing on brain differences is a belief that this is fixed. And this is why the understanding that our brains are plastic, in the flexible, moldable, changeable sense of the word, it is really important, because it means it doesn't matter if this is how your brain currently solves the problem, there are ways of changing that. So I think the danger lies in, you know, what I call weaponizing biology against, you know, whoever's behavior or underrepresentation or underperformance you're trying to explain.
In High Five Girls, we are working with girls and trying to improve their self-esteem and let them know that they can too do everything that matters with technology. If any parents listen to this podcast, how can they apply your knowledge in terms of raising their girls so they grew up with the same opportunities as boys, you know, in terms of getting same skills and self-esteem and et cetera?
Well, I think sometimes self-education is important, and parents generally are aware, and if you say, you may feel that you're treating your son and your daughter similarly, or your two daughters similarly, but you might need to take a step back and is this really the case? Are you telling girls one thing and boys another? Are you challenging the stories that girls are being told, for example, about superheroes and princesses, etc.? So I think that's important. And I think the whole issue of self-esteem, as you know, is really important, because we know that maintaining your self-esteem is a very important behavioural driver in human behaviour, almost as important as sort of more fundamental survival of, you know, and food and drink, etc. So I think not undermining anybody's ability, not assuming that they can't do something because they're male or female, or shouldn't do something because they're male or female, that's important. It's also important to note that there is an asymmetry in how parents treat boys and girls. There's some really interesting work coming out about toys, for example, who gets to play with what toys and what the downstream consequences of that are. And there's been a big focus on construction toys and girls, quite rightly. But the evidence is that parents are less anxious if girls play with what are called boys' toys, and that's a whole another issue, you know, what makes a toy a boy's toy. But they're more anxious if boys show interest in what are called girls' toys. And I think that's particularly the implications for caring and nurturing and being social are important. So just be aware of that difference. And parents aren't. There's some really interesting studies where parents will, you know, acclaim themselves to treat their children completely equally, but the children will have a different story, and boys will say they don't think their father would be happy if they wanted to wear a tutu or have ballet lessons, etc. So I think that's an important issue. And you know, great what organisations like High Five are doing. But I would just say, as a slight rider to that, this is always assuming that the problem, in inverted commas, is with the individual, and that you've got to train the people to be resilient or have the right skills and etc. I think a big issue, and that comes back to this idea that our brains are constantly in the outside world looking for the rules to determine our behaviour, there is still a big problem with culture and the way in which stereotypes have got themselves embedded in all sorts of cultural expectations. So yes, you need to focus on you know, what the children themselves do, but also have a look at, you know, the education system. You know, massive stereotyping in very early years, which perhaps in Scandinavia is not such a problem, but it can emerge.
What kind of stereotypes in the education system? What do you mean?
Well, I think in particular, in the UK, I was involved in a programme which was looking, it was called No More Boys and Girls, which was looking at stereotypes in classrooms, and looking at, took a group of, a class of 7-year-olds and followed them up over 6 weeks. And if you go into the classroom, there's very sort of unconscious differentiation a lot of the time. So there was a blue cupboard for the boys' coats and a pink cupboard for the girls' coats. The teacher referred to the girls as sweet pea and the boys as mates. And when they lined up to do something, the boys lined up separately from the girls. And, you know, a lot of people would be probably rolling their eyes now and talking about political correctness. But all of those are signalling differences. And I think that's what we need to be aware of. And the children themselves are, A, noticing the differences, but also, more importantly, noticing that those differences are valued differently. So girls, you know, 7-year-old girls were saying, it would be nice to be a boy because you could grow up to be president, kind of thing. So I think those kind of stereotypes, and, you know, if you go into a classroom and it's World Science Week or something, and all the pictures on the wall are of male scientists, etc. And again, you know, people will think eye-rolling political correctness, but it does make a difference. We also know that the brain changes according to the experiences that individuals have. And the classic example of that, particularly with respect to science, is spatial cognition, which is a particular cognitive skill which was allegedly much more characteristic of males than females, and therefore explained the higher representation of males in the scientific profession. But we know that that's actually a skill that can change with respect to spatial training, and that will change not only your ability to carry out this kind of task, it will also change the brain processes associated with it. So what it actually means that if our, you know, our brains are collecting rules in the outside world, our brains are changing according to experiences you have or don't have, and if you don't have particular experiences because of your gender, then that'd be another aspect. There's a great study done looking at girls who struggling with some spatial tasks, who were given 3 months of intensive Tetris training, so that they played this video game for a certain amount of time every day, and it was shown that their brain structure and function changed. They became much better, or the areas associated with spatial cognition became more active, and they also became better at spatial tasks, but also attitudes as well. So if you're given the same task but within a different social context, you know, people like you are good at this or people like you are not so good at this, we can demonstrate at the level of brain structure and function that that will change the brain. It shouldn't matter whether somebody is male or female, a girl or a boy, a man or a woman. What we need to know is what particular skills or personality characteristics are most appropriate for whatever it is we're trying to set up in society, and make sure the people with those appropriate skills and attitudes and personalities are matched with what we want. But we shouldn't, you know, let sex not be the only question we ask. You know, don't assume that all females are empathic and all males are logical and rational, because the data shows that they aren't. And if you bring that expectation to whatever it is you're trying to do, then you're doomed to failure. And very often that leads people to say, oh, that goes to show if you try and encourage girls to do this, then they don't do very well, or they leave, or whatever. So I think if we could get away from these male-female labels, that would make a big difference.
Du har lyttet til High Five Girls podcast. Hvis du ikke har hørt vores allerførste podcast, så synes jeg, at du skal gå tilbage og høre den. Da den giver dig en introduktion til foreningen High Five Girls, foreningens visioner, og hvor det bliver ridset op, hvorfor det er vigtigt, at der kommer mere diversitet i STEM. Tak fordi du lytter med.